Well, hello,
Log
everybody.
Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everybody out there. We'd like to welcome you to today's podcast. In this podcast, we have the opportunity and the honor to interview Mr. Nathan Shea. He is one of the co-founders of a company called SecureStrux, and they are based out of, if I'm correct, out of, I think, Arlington, Virginia. Nate, thanks for your time today,
yep.
And we look forward to your contribution here. So let's go ahead and get started.
Yes.
Thanks for having me. We looked up your bio, and you seem to have a really deep and rich background in cybersecurity. Obviously, you're going to get a CISSP. Can you tell us some of the highlights of your career and how you got started and how you kind of got to where you're at today?
Sure. Really started back in about 2000 timeframe, working with the U.S. Army War College in Pennsylvania, Carlisle area, and did a lot of security work for them, and then slowly migrated over to an agency called the Defense Information Systems Agency, which was out of Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, and now down at Fort Meade, and doing a lot of cybersecurity. It was the Field Security Office. And back then it wasn't cybersecurity, it was information warfare, and then eventually went to information assurance, and now maybe the past 3 years it's been cybersecurity, maybe 4 years, but a major rebrand for us as a company, because we had to change everything over from information assurance to cybersecurity. But did a lot of cybersecurity assessments for the agency. Went all around the world, actually, for mostly military installations, some clear defense contractor areas, and was just looking at the posture. I did mostly network assessments. It's usually a team that went out, and we did what was called a command cyber readiness inspection. And this was at first started by DISA, and then U.S. Cyber Command took the program over. And we were just an arm for U.S. Cyber Command doing these inspections for anything that was connected to the Department of Defense Information Network. And so I did that for several years, and even after I started my company, I was still doing some of these assessments and inspections and really kind of outside looks on the posture of these circuits, and give them a grade and everything like that. And then partly one of the reasons I started the company was I saw a lot of agencies and organizations that did not understand what they were being graded on, and they were all doing good things, but they didn't understand the process. So decided to go out and help these companies and organizations get ready for these inspections, and we still do that today to a degree. And but that was the impetus of me starting the company. And while I'm a firm believer in these third-party cybersecurity inspections and just having a second look, because we get tunnel vision on our own environments, and having someone else come from the outside that understands this can really kind of shed some light on the cybersecurity hygiene of an organization. So,
okay. Sounds excellent. Now, how did you come up with the concept of SecureStrux? Is this, obviously you've helped create this, you're a managing partner, but how did it come into being, or what was your impetus to your motivation started?
Yeah, well, I was actually taking a college course, a master's degree, and with Capella University, and I had the opportunity to, as one of my courses, to start a company, and I wanted to do that for a long time, and decided that would be one of my initiatives for that semester, and so that was the start of it. I didn't do a whole lot with it. That was down back in 2008. I didn't do a whole lot with it. Ran some projects through it, and still did a lot of work for the Department of Defense. And then in 2013 decided, hey, I'm going to make this jump, because, like I said, I just saw more and more organizations needing that third-party look and assistance. And, you know, cybersecurity was just starting to get right. There really wasn't a whole, there was not a real desire for it, especially in the commercial side of things in 2013, as much as it started to warm up. The appetite wasn't there that, you know, this was more of a requirement than a need, and meaning the requirement from the government to make sure that these agencies and organizations were secure, but not really like a true need from the organization itself saying, hey, I need to be secure or else I'm going to get attacked and I'm going to suffer consequences and I'm going to have to report up to a board. And, you know, my job's on the line type of thing. And then, you know, more and more money was to be made by the bad actors to infiltrate environments. So, that sped things up. And, so a real need, I think, especially in the 13-14 timeframe. So, we were ripe as far as our knowledge, and, we had quite a few good clients who kept us afloat and helped propel our past performance and gave us the experience we needed to, you know, launch a full-blown firm. So,
well, okay,
helped quite
sounds
a bit.
Excellent. Oh, wow. Okay, so how long have you been in business?
Well, I like to say about 12 years, but truly about 7. Like I said, I incorporated and established the company in 08. But in 13 is when I made the leap and got sponsored by Hewlett-Packard, HP. In the DoD world, it's a little more difficult to do business. You just don't just walk in and do business. You've got to have typically clearances, and you need to be able to hold clearances to have employees. So we had to have a need to have a facility clearance. And so HP had to be, and someone had to sponsor you for that. You had to have a contract that would require you to have clearances, have employees to manage those clearances. So in 13, HP sponsored us and really helped us kind of catapult us to being able to bring in more cleared people and allow us to do that. So, in 13 is when I say we were really started to run. So about 7 years, and typical growing pains like any other company as far as trying to figure it out. I feel like after 5 or 6 years, you just get a better idea of what it takes. So
very well, it's taken me 11 years to figure out my.
I don't think I'll figure it out completely, but we get there.
Yeah, it's kind of like a big jigsaw, a big work in process. But hey, congratulations on that. In fact, you made it so far that, you know, it's still, you know, a great effort.
Yeah.
Now, do you have
still alive.
Other countries? Yeah. Are you in other countries as well, or are you mostly in the East Coast area? Or?
So we did quite a bit of work under contract in other countries. We've been all around the world. Helping other organizations, mostly in the Department of Defense world, though, at bases, at the UN, in Brussels, but mostly in the auspice of carrying and feeding the DoD networks. As a company that we've grown inside of the North America, and we do work all over the U.S. We've done some work in Alaska and Hawaii, which some would consider, you know, outside of the U.S. But for the most part, we're based in U.S. and we are working with folks that have some type of need to be compliant with the Department of Defense. But it's not just an East Coast thing. We have customers in California and all the way in between. So. We do quite a bit of work with the Army National Guard. And the Army National Guard has obviously 50 states and some territories. So we're usually hopping around to different states, helping them out.
Okay. Now that kind of leads me to my next question. Like, who is your typical customer base? Is it the federal government mostly, the DOD, or do you target the private sector as well, like SMBs and Fortune 500 companies?
It's a great question. Yes, we've helped out some SMBs. Like I said, though, we got our start in the government, mostly Department of Defense, pivoted a little bit to the federal government, to the states with the Army National Guard. But predominantly, 85% of our, I would say, our revenue and business is done with some type of federal agency or the Department of Defense. Clear defense contractors as well. So folks that would be doing work directly for for the U.S. government, we're typically helping them out and giving them third-party looks and looking at their environment so that they're compliant. They're typically very large, and meaning they have many lines of business, and some lines of business get it and other lines don't. And we will typically come in and help where there's gaps and just give advisory services and that outside look to validate or to assist the gaps that are there, if they are there.
Okay. So. Sounds great. Now, I was looking at your website a few days ago. It seems like you have a lot of services, a lot of different cyber services, and different corporate capabilities, ranging from cyber as a service to cyber engineering to authorization and accreditation, vulnerability assessments, pen testing. Can you kind of explain a little bit about each of these services, if you can, in some detail, and like what's really resonating well with your company for right now?
Yeah. So penetration testing is a good chunk of our business. There's different levels of that, but we've helped different agencies and companies from internal pen testing as well as external, where no one knows that we're really knocking on the door, but one or two people in the organization. We do cyber as a service. It's some offerings that we have where a lot of organizations don't necessarily need a full-time person on site, but they need some assistance from the outside because there's these enterprise tools that, for whatever reason, an employee might move on and they need someone else trained up, or they just need to make sure that they're doing it the way the Department of Defense has asked them to do things. So we usually have some type of long-term agreement in place where we're coming and going once or twice a month with these organizations. We have folks that live all over the country and either ascend as a team or, individually are booked to help these organizations out. That's our, we call it cybersecurity as a service. We've also, this past year, started MSSP, so Managed Security Service Provider, and we have tools in place. We believe that with the wave of, there's a new certification out there called the Cybersecurity Maturity Model Certification, and this is really something that the Department of Defense cleared and uncleared defense contractors have to abide by their for decades, companies have been able to do their business without really any cybersecurity metrics and measures in place necessarily, and now they are being required to get some certain level of maturity, and there's five levels of maturity with this new CMMC requirement for the defense contractors. And depending on the contract that comes out, if it says that, hey, you need to be at maturity level 3 to even bid on this contract or to even do work on this contract, these organizations, companies are going to have to be assessed and a third-party validation or assessment be done on that company to go back to the government and say, yes, these guys or this organization does meet this level of security. They would be given a certification, and then they'd be able to bid on those contracts. Now there's like 300,000 that we've been told defense contractors out there that will have to at some level be at maturity 1 or maturity level 5, And so there's a way that's heading. Most people, I should correct myself. We believe that most people know about it, but there are still quite a few that don't quite get it yet. That this is something they're going to have to comply to, and it's a new requirement this year. So we are planning on getting certified if we can. There's still some ambiguity on how it's all going to shake out at this point, as far as who can be certifiers or not. But we've helped quite a few customers already get ready for this wave. But so several new initiatives that we've started over the past couple of years, because you just see this wave coming. We do a lot of command cyber readiness inspection assistance. Like I said earlier, U.S. Cyber Command has a inspection for anyone connected to their networks. And we have a team. We used to do quite a bit of work at the Pentagon and Defense Logistics Agency and DISA as well. And we have a team of certified folks that can go out there and help prepare large and small organizations, U.S. and abroad, get prepared for their CCRIs. So that's probably our nichiest of all of the work that we do. And usually, folks, we come in there and we help them out. We show them the blind spots, the gaps, do a gap analysis, and then that usually turns into, well, I don't know how to fix this. Can you help us fix it? And so we do have an engineering department that will come in and do the fix action and, be beside them all along the way, even during their inspection itself. So those are just some of the services that we do provide. Most of our folks are just very astute and have been around a long time with inside the defense silo and understand cybersecurity very well. I mean, I would say most of our folks were almost pioneers in the early 2000s, working with a lot of the standards that DISA puts out, and even NIST, the National Institute of Security, Standards and Technology. There's a lot of requirements, and some of our folks help write some of that guidance. So pretty early on, we were in front of that wave of best practices. So.
Wow, excellent. Now, when you talk about CyberServ, one thing I want to ask you, do you do like vCISO or vCIO services also? Or
we do. We have quite a few CISOs that rely on us. We come in on a monthly or just telephone calls, reports that help with their strategy long term, because some of the organizations we work with have like 15 different lines of business, and each line of business might have a different piece of compliance, whether it's health or risk management for a particular DoD agency, and then a different agency that requires something a little bit different. So we try to sit at that level and help that CISO navigate the waters, keep on top of their various inspections and what they need to comply with, and then try to map that between the different compliance requirements, and just be a resource to them on the changes that are coming up, as well as build out a path to success is what we like to call it, so that at any time if they're inspected or have some type of third party come in, they're ready and have their documentation and their processes and procedures in place, help out with continuity of operations and that kind of thing. So we work at that level, and it's great to see that there's just been more desire for that. I believe prior to these positions being made, it just was not a priority, and I can just over the past 4 years, it's been just a huge shift in mindset. Nobody wants to be caught, holding the bag whenever something happens. And so, we prepare them for that event.
Okay. Well, so you said pen testing was your biggest revenue generator, your biggest
is one of them.
Piece of the pie. Do you have any like an exciting Cloak and Dagger stories you want to share with our audience? I've interviewed a lot of pen testers, and you know, some of them have some exciting stories, and I don't really want to share. I mean, if you have any, that'd be great. If not, do you have any customer success stories you'd like to share with us?
We have a couple. I would just say one in particular would help the customer out, and a lot of zero day vulnerabilities that were found and were able to be exploited from a friendly standpoint. It didn't get to the point where they were exploited and we had to bring in forensics and kind of back it out how did it all happen. But honestly, it happens quite often where we're able to find an exploit, a zero-day type of exploit from the outside with our credentials, and then be able to use our tools to exploit that vulnerability, shown how it happened, and then, kind of do a replay for them. There's just multiple ones. It hasn't been anything crazy the past 6 months, but we've had a few in, I would say, the 2017, late 2018 time frame, where we just had a lot of activity and a lot of aha moments. Wasn't anything where they were exploited by the outside, and it wasn't anything where we found bad actors in the environment or anything like that. We didn't have to bring in any other third parties to do further analysis. But in the 2017, 2018, there were some really good nuggets that we were able to help a few of our customers out with, which makes for good word of mouth and good storytelling.
Sure. Okay. Excellent. Now we're starting. Like, it's hard to believe that January is already almost over. It still feels like the holidays here. Now, as we know, our fast tracking into 2020 and even into this decade, I can't believe we're in a new decade. What do you see in the industry today? I think one of the questions you had for me was like the staffing challenges. We all know that there's a severe workforce shortage in the cybersecurity industry, but I think it's kind of like a catch-22. I think managers want only experienced people, but they don't want to hire like people straight out of college or with any certs. They don't want to waste time training. So, what are your thoughts on this? Do you guys do any staffing or any IT or any like cybersecurity placements for clients, or do you do consulting like that? Or
yeah, there's a little bit of each. I mean, we have a few that we do intern. I mean, we have one or two that are still in college that we bring in the summertime. It's great because some of these are Army National Guard. So they're employed by them. They have their clearances. The Army National Guard is getting their certs for them. But we're able to give them the experience, the real-world experience. We have a very mature staff that can been around a long time and mentor them, and that's I really enjoy that piece of it. So that's some of our staffing comes from that organic bringing people in while they're still in college and, you know, trying to mature them and grow them within inside the company. We like to think that we are a white glove type of company, so we're trying to hire the best. There's always some junior folks that we think have a ton of potential and are smart, maybe lack a little bit of the experience, so we will we'll invest in them and get them certified and bring them up. But hiring, especially in the D.C. area, in the Northern Virginia area, it's just a difficult process in that. And I like to say, like, you could have a new job in D.C. probably every month for the rest of your life if you wanted to, because there's just so many jobs that are in that area, in the D.C., Virginia area, that for cybersecurity. So you could hop all around all you want, probably get a little bump here and there. But honestly, trying to find people that really know this work is tough. some certifications we put more weight to than others. I believe the CISSP really shows that there's some seriousness there, but there are several in the middle as well as the beginning that are not terribly difficult to obtain. And so even if they're certified and they have a few years under their belt, it's still tough to find, you know, people that will fit the culture of the company and our core values, and then on top be really smart with the technologies that we need to hire for. And then on top of that, they need to have a clearance typically for us to start, you know, working with most of our customers, because they're working with Department of Defense customers that require some type of level of clearance. So we're pretty agnostic to the location of where people need to work to work for SecureStrux. So that does help alleviate things. Like if I had to staff solely in the DC area, it's very competitive there. There's turnover. It's really tough to build a strong culture, the same type of employee. Not impossible, but just more difficult. Like, but when you can hire in, say Michigan or down in, New Mexico and Texas and other areas where it just opens up your availability for hiring good talent. And so there are plenty of challenges for sure, but we have some strategies, and we've been very successful. For a while there, we weren't really hiring to our core values. We were just, hey, he's a smart guy, and he's got this X, Y, and Z certification, and he has a clearance. Awesome, let's hire him. And, so we went through a little bit of attrition there just because they weren't fitting the core values and the level of expectation that we require. And so we've tightened some things up there from our hiring perspective. So it does take us a little bit longer because we're trying to find long-term good fits. And we've been very successful in the past year or so just finding that type of talent, even though it takes a little longer and a little more vetting. We believe we've done a good job in that area. But overall, the industry is struggling because, there is such a huge need for good, solid cybersecurity people. And there's a lot of people out there with certs and a lot of people out there that have worked for organizations that just kind of check the boxes. And the clients that we are serving, it's much more than just checking boxes for sure. It's doing the tough part of the engineering, and it's many times reverse engineering problems to make organizations compliant. We love when we can just walk into the environment and build it from scratch and bake the security in. Much easier to do than try to detangle security problems after they've been living with the environment for, a few years. So.
Do you foresee this as a problem coming down the decade, this severe workforce shortage? I mean, do you think it's going to be a long-lasting problem? Or
I think we're going to be feeling it for the next 3 to 5 years, the shortage, because there is still quite a bit of change. I think the nut is starting to get cracked. And the industry is starting to figure it out, starting to automate. I tell anyone new that comes in or people that are seeking advice that you need to learn to code, because this world is going to automation, AI. It's going to get smarter.
Right.
You're going to have to learn how to automate a lot of the compliance work that we do now. And I see it already. It's getting smarter and sharper, but you still need people to run those tools. You still need people to get us to the other side of a more robust cybersecurity environment. And, so I would say it's next 3 to 5 years, very intense. Commercial world still trying to catch up. There's still some industry sectors that I feel are starting that are just like, whoa, we need people that really know this stuff, not just engineers, but people that understand the requirements and the best practices and can start to do some correlation. And I see the manufacturing industry is one of those where they're really needing to, but they're really starting to ramp up. They're seeing that, wow, this is more than just a help desk or engineering person to solve this problem. It's a dedicated requirement, and it just takes time. So still a lot of opportunity, I think, in this field, and manufacturing is just one of them. So,
right. Okay. Now, we talk about ROI here in cybersecurity. In this industry, there are a lot of metrics that are coming out these days. In fact, I just wrote a blog posting on some of the latest metrics and some of the big buzzwords that are coming out there. You've talked about cyber hygiene. What's the biggest ROI that you see for companies in cybersecurity? What's cyber hygiene in your view? And how do you help companies improve that cyber hygiene, both from the business perspective and for their employees mostly, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of good frameworks out there. NIST, National Institute of Standards and Technology, has a library of best practices. The Department of Defense has what they call security technical implementation guides. There's a lot of good stuff that's already out there. It's not like you got to recreate the wheel. You just got to use the information that's out there and that's been developed. Most major vendors are baking security in at this point, or giving you guidance on how to secure environments. I've already said it, and it's a shameless plug here, but we believe that having some type of third-party assessment will really increase your return on investment when it comes to understanding the fastest, most efficient way forward on how to get better, to have a healthy and robust environment for your systems and your networks. So having a third-party assessment helps uncover the problems. We pull the rocks back. Most companies that do this will pull the rocks back and look in the corners and look at the what-ifs and provide you some type of path forward. And also just having an organization or someone that can come in on a regular basis and keep the organization honest. As a CISO or a CEO, you can get pretty comfortable with your IT shop and what they're reporting to you. And having someone come from the outside, help those folks out, give them the little one leg up, as well as give a no kidding report to your CEO on like the progress that's being made. There's a lot of value in having someone from the outside look at those things and expertise in that industry. So, you know, I wouldn't come into a hospital and be like, hey, this is the way it should be done, because my expertise is not in the healthcare industry necessarily like it is in the DoD. So pick a vendor or a company that knows that industry very well and could provide a lot of tips and tricks that they're seeing from other companies or organizations of similar similar industry. That's the one thing I think that helps us stand out, is when we come in and do these third-party assessments, are the value that our clients are getting is that we have seen 100 other organizations, and some of these organizations are doing things really well, are very mature, and we can take some of those nuggets and bring it into another organization that might not be as mature or just doesn't have that particular technology in place that would really just, help catapult the next level. And so there's a lot of value, and there's a a good return on investment. Just like maybe somebody needs a little help with their weight, they might get a nutritionist. The nutritionist would help them out. Or somebody in the business world might have a mentor or someone that helped them with strategy. Same type of concept with cybersecurity. You get just a ton of value out of bringing somebody in that can has been around and you know, has seen what good looks like. So.
Okay, excellent. It's interesting you talk about the third party coming in to give assessment to another company, because I've had a couple of clients ask me from a writing standpoint to come up like with the pros and cons of hiring like an outside third party to, especially in this area of writing secure source code, you know, when it comes to like API security and, you know, like web application security. I've had a couple of clients kind of ask me, well, can you write a piece on testing the security of your code in-house versus out-house, or out-of-house, I should say. And honestly, I think, hands down, I would say go out-of-house, because if you test inside, you're going to have that biasness, and there are a lot of things I think you're going to overlook. And for that matter, I mean, I think you get third parties, but I think, honestly, I'm not even a huge fan of, like, international outsourcing either. I think, you know, hire good people here in the U.S., you know, because there's a lot of good qualified workers and all that. You know, it's like you get what you pay for, right? I mean, you don't want to pay someone really cheap to do this, because you really want to make sure, because I, of all things, I had a client, he had a pen testing company. One of his clients got a piece of some web app code from someone they had developed, and then their stuff was breached. Now they're like in a huge lawsuit right now just because they didn't test the codes. Yeah. So it's very interesting about these third-party assessments. So.
Yeah, I mean, you think about it. Like, your business, whatever the business may be, let's just say it's pharmaceuticals, your business is to sell that drug. Your business is not cybersecurity. And you just want to do your business. And it's just like me. I want to do my business, but I got to drive a car to work. And I'm not a mechanic. So my car breaks down. It's a vehicle for me to get to and from the job that generates me income. So I'm not gonna. I can bring a mechanic in house for my once a, you know, or twice a year type of thing, and spend a lot of money on that person just to bring him in house to do the mechanics, or I can find somebody that's specialized and can do that for me, or I could teach myself. But I don't have time to do that, and that's not the business I want to be in. So I'm going to outsource that to a mechanic who knows how to fix my vehicle. And it's the same thing with cybersecurity. Unless that's your business, you're more than likely going to either, if you're in the middle there and you don't have the resources to bring somebody in full time, you're probably going to outsource that to a third party. And even if you are a large organization, you want to have that assurance that the people that you have brought in to do that work, that they're doing it the right way, that they're, and you can keep them honest by bringing a third party in, not just keep them honest, but even help them. And that's the one thing we like to say, is we just don't come in and punch you in the nose and say, hey, good luck, you stink, but, you know, here are your results. We like to come in and say, you know, work shoulder to shoulder and help them get better and say, hey, here's where you were, here's where you are now. You know, let us know if you, you know, need more help. So.
Right.
You know, so there are probably some pros and cons. It just depends on the business and, you know, what your goals are.
Right. Okay. Well, now what do you see the biggest change coming in the next few months? You know, hopefully it'll be summertime soon here. We can get away from this winter weather. What do you think is going to happen in the next few months?
Well, I mean, I can't speak for every industry. I'm going to speak for the industry that I know best, which is the defense industry. And like I alluded to earlier, the cybersecurity maturity model certification is for real. There's a lot of effort being put on by the Department of Defense to get their supply chain in order. And that is something that in general has been overlooked, in that we're going to outsource to other countries. We're going to trust that they are making the product the way You know, we said they would, and that, you know, there's not going to be any problems in the middle. And, you know, there have been with the hiring process of some of these clear defense contractors in bringing foreign nationals in and to do work that they probably shouldn't have access to, or they're grabbing information and you know, sending it back. It's always been a threat. But also just making sure the products that we're bringing into these Department of Defense environments are can be has some level of assurance. And for the longest time, I think you know, Department of Defense with its contractors are just hoping and praying that you know, they were their contractor had their best interest. But we've seen that whether you know, whether they try to or not. There have been compromises. And so the CMMC certification for the Department of Defense is very close around the corner. They are very close to, within the next couple of weeks, locking down the requirements for what a clear defense contractor must do for each maturity level, 1 through 5. So that is very imminent. And then June time frame, and there are some benchmarks for the June time frame, and then also the September time frame for when contractors, clear defense contractors, need to have their house in order. And then the language will be then put into contracts that will basically enforce whether you can bid on defense contracts based off of your certification level. So that is this year. And so organizations are starting to bring in companies to help them get ready for that from an engineering standpoint, as well as like, hey, can you just give me a good idea of where I'm going to fall on this, so when I do get an official audit, I have some type of idea of where, you know, where I'm going to stand for that certification. Because for many of these defense contractors, including ourselves, if we don't meet that level of assurance, then there's a high potential that we might not be able to do business with some of our primary customers, which is the Department of Defense. So we need to make sure we get it right. And so we're not just cleaning up our own house and making sure our, you know, our I's are dotted and T's are crossed, but also helping our clients meet those requirements that are about to hit. And so they can stay in business, continue to do, you know, make rivets, make helmets, make bullets, all everything that goes in the Department of Defense. It's a huge range from, you know, airplanes down to, you know, just the way you would make a little rivet. Anyone doing work in the supply chain is going to be affected at some level. So that's the big push for this year for the Department of Defense. And then the framework that they're using too is something that could be applied to almost any industry that doesn't have a framework in place. It's a very sensible, pragmatic framework of at, you know, a pretty moderate level of security, just based on the requirements they're providing. Most companies should be doing, just to protect their own IP and company property.
Okay. Now, as we kind of come into the last part of the show, there's the few, like, cybersecurity industry, you know, things I want to talk more in a macro sense. There are other issues that I'm kind of aware of, you know, like one of them is holding the C-suite more accountable, you know, like, people say, oh, you've been hit by cyber attack, you know, the CISO or the CIO, their head should roll, they should be fired, blah, blah, blah. But I'm the kind of guy, I like to take a holistic approach. If you see what's happened, then cast the blame, then hold people responsible. I don't like to have knee-jerk reactions. I think it's the worst thing someone can do in cyber. What are your thoughts on this? The C-suite, hold them accountable. Does the buck really stop with them, or does it stop with the whole company, like with the employees? Especially.
Well, it's a trickle down. We've always said this: it's a trickle down from leadership. When leadership takes it seriously, the rest of the organization will. It's really tough to push policy and processes from the bottom up. You know, the CEOs and C-suite, they're going to drive the direction. And if they're taking it seriously, the rest of the organization will take it seriously. If there's a board of directors, especially, that C-suite can be held accountable at that level. And, you know, it's again, I'm speaking from the clear defense contractor world and the defense world, you know, your contracts could be cut off if you're not able, if you're not meeting some of this, I wouldn't say their requirements, but if you're not meeting some of these cybersecurity requirements, you're not going to be doing business, which means you're going to be doing a huge disservice by your employees and even yourself, because lines of business could be shut down. So, you know, the teeth is there if you have a board of directors, and then just having the best interest of your company, it behooves you to get smart in this, and for the retention of employees as well. But it's not going to happen the other way around. It's not going to happen from the bottom up.
Okay. Now, you know, we have, look, not to get political here, but, you know, he works with DOD and all that, but, you know, we've got the next presidential election coming up, and there's already, even since last year, talk about Russian meddling, North Korea, blah, blah, blah. Then there's this thing called deepfakes. You know, we're using AI to, you know, mimic, you know, real sounding pictures, videos, images of, like, Donald Trump asking for donations or whoever the Democratic contender will be. That's pretty scary. I mean, we may not see so much of, like, meddling, but more of this AI being used to trick, you know, voters into donating into voting fictitious, you know, bank accounts. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, like, are AI and deepfake and the whole thing with this election coming up?
Well, I guess I could say the same thing as, you know, we all have, I don't know, your grandparents or parents, you know, they gave to organizations, and people are always mailing them and, you know, the next best thing. And, you know, it's a matter of knowing who you're giving to and, you know, doing your homework. And I guess it's the same thing that you're bringing up here is, you know, if you're getting contacted, you know what the source is, make sure you're, you know, people called all the time on phones asking for money and giving to this organization and giving a sob story. You've got to use your own common sense, due diligence. And, you know, I think we've all, at least I have, I know, you get pretty far down the path sometimes, but some of these phone calls, and they sound legit, and, you know, you get smart after a couple of questions. But, you know, it's just a matter of, to me, there's part of it's common sense, and part of it is just knowing who you're giving to and who you're dealing with. It is getting more and more sophisticated. I think last year, just don't want to go down a rabbit trail, but last year we got, we had two phishing incidents where one of our employees, two different employees got, you know, hit. And we're a cybersecurity company. We do cybersecurity training. And something came across, right, and it looked legit. And, you know, they took the bait. We were able to quickly fix it. But, you know, that's we had people that were, once they clicked the wrong thing, they're like, I think I just clicked the wrong thing. And they are quick to react and get it fixed. So, you know, when you're dealing with credit card companies, too, if you're giving to a political party, you know, there's usually things in place for that as well. And, again, it's just, part of it's common sense, and part of it's staying smart and your ears perked up. So can't do much about what the Russian and the Koreans are doing. I feel you know they're gonna try to influence elections, and you know, one way or the other, we just need to have a good solid voting system in place. And what I've heard and read, you know, the actual votes weren't the problem. There might have been influence based on Facebook and you know, propaganda. But when it came to actually pulling the lever, and there weren't any Russians or Koreans pushing the buttons or anything like that. It was more or less trying to influence based off of, you know, just propaganda.
Great. Well, it kind of comes down to this one thing, you know, everybody's prone to becoming a victim of a cyber attack. You know, no matter how much you do, you're never really immune. But things, if you do become a victim, then how proactive are you in correcting so that you don't get further damage, you know, happening?
The bottom line is most organizations, most people get compromised at some level, and it's a matter of having some type of plan to mitigate, and hopefully it would be you catch it early and are able to recover quickly. So same, I think with most things in life, we have car insurance because we know it's not a matter of if we're going to get hit by another car or have an accident, we're going to have one, and it's just a matter of putting things in place to recover quickly.
Right. Well, it's interesting because I had a relative here in the U.S. call me last thing saying, hey, I lost my iPad. What do I do? And I said, well, how long ago did you? Oh, I lost it 2 weeks ago in the plane leaving California.
Yeah.
So
pretty much.
So I'm going, you better do this very, very quickly so you don't become a victim of ID theft, you know. So anyway.
Yeah.
But now, kind of going on this insurance thing you just brought up, I'm actually going to be writing a book on cybersecurity insurance coming up here in the next, probably in the summertime. And that's another hot button topic here in the cyber industry.
Sure.
Insurance. Have you guys dealt with that for your clients, you know, doing like third party? I mean, do you give advice in that regard or something that you never really thought too much of? Or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, most of the work we do, we're required to have it. And so we have that in place for ourselves. Read the fine print. There's still not a ton of these insurance companies don't have a ton of history. So there's still, you might think you're covered for, $500,000, $1 million, and then there's some fine print that if X, Y, and Z happens, you're really not going to be insured for that much. So that's been what I've read, and when I've talked to other people that have had it, is to make sure you read that fine print and what you're really being covered for. With cybersecurity insurance, it's for me, I feel like being a third party again, there's a huge opportunity for a company like ourselves with doing cybersecurity insurance, and in that like for my home, I get a discount if I have an alarm system, and if I can prove an alarm system, I get like a 10% discount. Same thing with a company, there should be some type of incentive to have a third party come out and do some type of assessment. If you get a pen test once a year, you get a 5% discount. If you do some type of training for your employees, you get some type of discount. Insurance hasn't come that far yet, but this would take this would take some of the risk off of the insurance companies, is if they had some of these things being done by the company. I think it would reduce their the risk that they would have, at least from an insider perspective with some of the training, better than nothing. But, we're required to have it. I advise other folks to have it, but make sure you read that fine print and see what you're really being covered for and then mitigate around it. It's just like I have car insurance if I don't have collision, so I know that if I'm protected if there's a bad actor out there and he hits me, but if I hit someone else, I'm footing the bill. So know what you're insured for.
Okay. Now, the one other trend I want to ask you about was the Internet of Things. It's where everything's all connected together. I think it's a very scary proposition in my opinion. I'm not a fan of it at all. I like to keep things simple and kind of analog. In fact, I've got like a 16-year-old Honda Civic. I just don't like the way these cars are these days. What are your thoughts on the IoT? Have you guys done any work on this thing called the Internet of Things? Or what are your thoughts?
Well, they all hang off, and when we do a lot of our pen testing and we do our vulnerability assessments, they all come into play. Anything that's connected to your network comes into play and has a potential. We did a lot of work when we were at the Pentagon with the SCADA environment, elevators and door, automatic doors and card readers and that kind of things that are separate from the rest of the network. And that's one of the things, the ability to do that with IoT is to separate it, be in and out, put it in its own segmented part of the network to do so. Most folks don't. They, you know, most houses, most people don't have that, the wherewithal or the savviness to segment that kind of stuff off. But what we did find in, which is better today than it than in the past, is a lot of these things had were old technology, were not being able to be updated because they were completely isolated from the internet. But that's the whole thing with IoT, is so that you know, that the vendor can get a better idea of the way a product's being used and how they're being used within the home or the environment, so that they can sell you more, as well as you getting some benefit from the product itself. But they do have access to the internet. They do have access, hopefully, to getting vulnerabilities updated. But like we dealt with in the past, you know, folks don't always update these peripheral technologies that are out in the wing, and they are potentially a vector for penetration and for the to get to the rest of the environment. Cameras, baby cameras, the little timers that are on for Christmas trees and for lights, they might not be necessarily as capable as some other type of equipment for you know, getting to maybe computer systems, but they are on the LAN or the inside of the environment, and I guess depending on what that IoT is, you know, there's potential to make life difficult for you in shutting down lights, shutting down the refrigerator, you know, maybe not letting the car work, or even like you said, you drove an old Civic, but even accidents itself. But it's probably the new reality, and
right.
You know, organizations, companies are going to be held responsible, I believe, for ensuring their products are you know, have the ability to remain secure. They might not be at fault if you don't keep it updated, but if they don't give you an avenue for keeping it updated, I think there's probably some liability there.
Okay. Now, in 2020, what do you think the biggest cyber threat is going to be? What do you think will be the top thing? Is it going to be ransomware, BEC, phishing? One thing I've been writing about is attack to critical infrastructure, where we could kind of select another 9/11 style attack, but not having planes go through a building, but
yeah,
having a cyber attack somewhere inside the
building. Yeah, I mean, I feel, you know, I think that is still the one thing that really hasn't happened, that is just, if that happens, the infrastructure is there. Like, there's still plenty of avenues into the infrastructure, whether it be electric or gas. And those two areas itself are scary, just because
right.
How dependent we are on electricity and our Wi-Fi systems. You know, you can barely open up a computer anymore without most of your data being in the cloud. And if it's in the cloud and you can't access it, or you don't have the power to access it, you know, how do you get your legal documents? How do you do what most of us do to do our jobs? I don't know if there's a real mitigation with that just yet. I think that we're getting closer with satellites as a redundancy. And, you know, if your Wi-Fi goes down, you have a hotspot with your phone, so there's some redundancy type of things there. But when it comes to electricity, I don't, and that whole industry, I've always said, some of my colleagues is, they just need two internet. They need an internet for like all the people that do their web surfing and social media, and then they need an infrastructure network that is just off of that dirty network, and it's just completely isolated. And, you know, the stock exchange, whatever the U.S. would deem as critical infrastructure is on a whole separate network. There's no crossing over in any way, shape, or form. It's just two separate networks. You have the internet, and then you have this. And it's very intertwined still, as much as there might be technical controls in place and some isolation, full isolation. There's still just a lot of entanglement for these infrastructures to, to be, for there just to be some type of insider threat or, external bad actor. So, but yeah, I, that's the one, the electrical grid. I think many would argue that that is still a pretty critical and unguarded infrastructure that there's a lot of concern wrapped around. So.
Yeah, in fact, I just wrote a blog post, and I think on Saturday or Sunday, about, four ways cyber attacking can hit the power grid. It's pretty scary. I mean, there's just not a lot out there affected.
Yeah, I couldn't predict the future. I'm much more on the defensive side than I'm the offensive side. I feel like if you have a good framework and you do a lot of the best practices, which, surprisingly isn't done as often as you would think, but doing those best practices doing it often and having frequent, self-checks, outside checks, you're way ahead of the curve. You are not the target. The target is usually the soft targets that folks that just, don't make that a priority.
Well, now as we wrap up our show now, Nate, I'm going to say the best for last. What do you tell people to protect themselves and businesses to mitigate the risk? I shouldn't say prevent, but to mitigate the risk of being a victim from a cyber attack. Do you have like a laundry list of the top 3 or 4 items you can share with us? Or?
Well, you start from the boundary. Start from the outside and work your way in. From a computer standpoint or from a network standpoint, anything that's forward facing, anything that can be accessed from the outside, websites, databases, SharePoint, email, those type of things, need to have extra precautions taken. Just less is the best policy. So ports that are open to those particular things that are forward-facing, assets that are forward-facing, put them in DMZs. Anything that's forward-facing is the potential for attack. From an internal standpoint, have a good DLP solution in place. Being able to take IP and critical data off of a corporate network, you need to have visibility to that type of information, especially for employees that are looking to move on. From an insider threat, it's critical that you have visibility to those type of files, and then also just putting them in places, making sure that you have restrictions on their shares in those environments where, that is your business. And, some companies and organizations work with, they're very robust. They have all kinds of controls in place. And it's incredible. Like, as soon as somebody's given their 2 weeks or something like that, all kinds of activity happens so that access is minimized to just the things that they need. So from an external and internal standpoint, those are the two areas I would spend most of my time from a cybersecurity perspective. Obviously, antivirus, ransomware, it's all real. But being able to have visibility, which, again, is like the SANS top 20. The number one thing is organizations having visibility to their assets. So knowing what's on your network, having good, solid port security in place so anyone cannot just connect their machines, their home machines, their contractor machines to your environment, when they come in. Again, another, top 5 thing is restricting that type of access, but knowing what you have, and then also having just a clear supply chain and the equipment that you're purchasing and what you're bringing into your environment is going through some type of certification process or is at minimum U.S. made. Again, this is mostly when I deal with our clients with the Department of Defense is, just making sure that you've got a clean start. And that starts with your vendors and who you're buying from. So those are just some of the things. There's plenty of others. Bringing in a third party, again, I'll preach it till the day I die, is having somebody come in that can give you good advice, especially if that's not your industry. So, and then I guess the last thing too is make it simple. It doesn't have to be complicated. It can be much simpler than what most people make it. And being able to systematize and repeat your processes from a cybersecurity standpoint will make your life so much easier. Getting like hardware, having like operating systems, that makes life a whole heck of a lot easier. So.
Sure. Well, Nate, we thank you for your time this afternoon, and it was a great podcast. We look forward to having you again here in the future.
Thanks, Robbie. It's been great. Appreciate the opportunity, and thanks for a good conversation.
Thanks for your time. Bye.
Yep.